Hello and welcome to Resurrected Reviews Revisited, part of the Will You Still Love It Tomorrow podcast. I'm Annie, and in each reviews episode I pick something I've reviewed sometime since 2005, reread or rewatch it, and then compare my reactions. Fair warning, there will be spoilers. This month, my pick is Shrines of Gaiety by Kate Atkinson, which I randomly came across in a charity shop recently and decided to revisit when it caught my eye and brought up good associations, but no real memory of the plot. I should say at the outset, though, that this episode has content warnings for sexual violence and abortion. The book tells the story of Nellie Coker, head of a notorious crime family in 1920s London, and all the various trials and tribulations they face when various factions start trying to destroy their empire. Before revisiting it, my recollections of my original experience of encountering this book are as follows. I know I read it at a reading retreat because I have strong memories of reading bits out of it to Cressy in the kitchen. I remember there's a character who's a writer, and I thought the aspects about him trying to write his book were hilarious and very true to life. I also remember perhaps a 1920s setting and something about organised crime. And I think there was a strong female protagonist, but that's honestly about it. 2019, maybe? Here's what I thought on revisiting it this year. I was right about the time period since the book opens in 1926. I'm so used to historical fiction being either Victorian or World War II, so this makes nice change. But the story itself is immediately both confusing and annoying, since the viewpoint in the first few pages is horribly muddled. It's mostly from the point of view of a young newspaper boy witnessing the release of Nellie Coker, head of a notorious London crime family, from Holloway Prison. But we also get a couple of paragraphs from the viewpoint of a photographer, as well as Nellie's son Ramsay, and a clear universal authorial voice. One brief section is separated by line breaks, which would make sense to denote a change of viewpoint, and that is when it switches to Ramsay, but even that section also has thoughts from both the newspaper boy and the authorial voice, which makes the formatting even more confusing. Hey-ho! The presentation of Nellie's family, with her daughters fawning over her but purely for the benefit of the cameras, is intriguing, and the initial characterisation of Ramsay wanting fame in his own right but being immediately criticised by his mother in the first moment of their reunion is very effective. When the viewpoint changes yet again to a new character in the middle of a paragraph on the following page, I decide I have to just let it go, otherwise I'm not going to get very far with this book at all. But I am wondering if my previous reading of this book somehow predates my strong aversion to head-hopping in narratives, or if I similarly decided to overlook it last time as well. Luckily, the intrigue ramps up very quickly with the introduction of Gwendolyn Kelling at the end of the first chapter, who is asked by Detective Chief Inspector John Frobisher to infiltrate the Coker family empire in order to help him bring them down. But then, after 7 pages of direct action, we get 20 pages of background exposition about Nellie and her 6 children, which is a lot to process in a big lump and stops the story in its tracks before it's even really started. So, in the first 30 pages, I have to admit, I'm struggling a bit and wondering why I have such good recollections about this book. The plot inches forwards a bit in the next chapter with Inspector Frobisher arriving at Bow Street to start work, on his day off, no less, but we also get quite a lot of background about him, along with a great deal of telling about his character and attitudes. He's not particularly likeable, which I sense is going to be true of most of the characters in this book, but that's not a deal-breaker for me. His attitudes towards women, and particularly his own wife, are a little troubling, though. And then we grind to a halt again, with a chapter introducing an entirely new character, 14-year-old Frida, who has run away from home to be a star on the stage, and we get her whole backstory as a child knitwear model before we move on with the main plot. I mean, setting aside the constant slipping between omniscient authorial viewpoint and egregious head-hopping, the writing is good, the character studies are excellent, and the setting is well realised. But I would like all the background information to be a bit more integrated with the plot, and for the plot to make some progress at some point. I'm not exactly finding it hard to keep reading, but I did start out by calculating how many pages I need to read per day to finish the book by my preferred recording date, and I'm so far only reading that many and then setting it aside for the day, which isn't a ringing endorsement. We're told Nellie had a vision while in prison of the ghost of a nightclub hostess who died in one of her clubs, but it's not clear if this is a real supernatural element of the story or if it's just Nellie's guilty mind playing tricks on her. Nellie also uses cartomancy to inform her thoughts and decisions, and again, it's not clear to begin with if the supposed power behind the cards is real. At the time of recording, I've just finished a chunky book I really enjoyed, and also didn't get around to reading any more of Shrines of Gaiety on day 3 of my scheduled reading time for it, so I've decided, since I'm going to be largely at home for a few days, I'm not going to start another non-podcast book, and instead I'm going to dedicate all my reading time to this one for a bit. And then I went into one of my local charity shops during the afternoon and picked up 3 books for £1, one of which looks really intriguing, and now I don't want to read this again. But I managed to knuckle down at nearly 10 p.m. to read some more. At the start of the next chapter, we get a whole 5 lines of actual plot, with Frobisher and Gwendolyn surveilling the Coker clan as they leave the Amethyst Club, and then 12 pages of Gwendolyn's background, which is very sad and dreary, though I immediately like her as a character. But it's getting a bit ridiculous now, and I'm not sure how much more I can take. After 70 pages, we've had an opening 7-page chapter of actual story, then 4 or 5 in-depth character studies with another 10 pages of actual story scattered in between. So it's been 25% plot to 75% background info so far. Why do I think I liked this book when I read it before? There's another whole chapter of background information that only goes back to the day before and does connect all the disparate threads together by revealing that Gwendolyn has come to London to trace the runaway Frieda and approached Frobisher for help. He then suggested she check the Amethyst Club for any signs of her and then report back to him on anything interesting she discovers about the Cokers. Then we get 12 pages of the younger Coker generation having breakfast, which has some amusing tidbits of information, particularly the first references to Ramsay's attempts to write a novel, which I remember being my favourite aspect of the book. But even though it's the narrative that's in the present day of the story, it doesn't move the plot on one bit. In the next chapter, Nellie's oldest son Niven goes to the barber. And in the one after that, Gwendolyn buys some clothes. There's a slight frisson of possible excitement when the two of them have a brief encounter in the street, but nothing comes of it, or at least not yet. We're now over 100 pages in, and nothing has happened at all apart from Nellie being released from prison, which happened in the first 2 pages. We then get another chapter of background for Frieda, this time without even any pretense at moving on the plot. Then, after setting out to the morgue on page 35, Frobisher finally arrives there to inspect a body on page 121, but that's all we get. You get the idea, so I'm going to stop cataloguing the lack of forward progress, otherwise we'll be here all day. The very small bits of plot we do get, Frobisher sending Gwendolyn to infiltrate the Amethyst, the mysterious Atzapardi offering to buy all Nellie's clubs, the drowned girl in the morgue, are all rather disparate and nebulous as well. But I absolutely love the first hints of romance between Niven and Gwendolyn, especially Niven's strong reaction against his attraction, though the references are very few and far between, and I don't remember if it goes anywhere. And then we get a chapter of Ramsay writing his novel, and I don't care that it has nothing to do with the plot because it's hilarious and glorious in exactly the way I remembered, except for being way too short. It feels like the book starts to pick up a bit around page 150, and then slows right down again without really going anywhere. But the writing in general is very good. Atkinson's, not Ramsay's. There's another small hint of both plot and connection when Ramsay finds a discarded silver shoe in the storeroom of the club he's responsible for running. He doesn't understand its significance, but we as readers are aware that it matches the shoe worn by the drowned girl Frobisher inspected earlier at the morgue. But again, it's an almost throwaway couple of lines amidst a sea of Ramsay's random thoughts and actions. And then we get another sliver of connection when Nellie's oldest daughter Edith visits a house where abortions are carried out, which happens also to be where Frieda and Florence, the runaways, are boarding, and which Gwendolyn has also visited in her search for them. But it's still very tenuous and isn't likely to bring any of those characters together in a meaningful way. There's an interesting exchange between Ramsay and someone of his acquaintance named Vivian Quinn. "Is it true you're writing a novel, Quinn? What's it about?" "About? Does a novel have to be about something?" "Generally speaking." How banal. So I guess that might explain it, though Quinn is not presented as a sympathetic character, so it's odd to give him potentially the author's voice to make this statement. Things then suddenly ramp up quite spectacularly and all crash together at the halfway point when there's a brawl at the Amethyst, someone gets shot, and Gwendolyn, who has finally made it to her club surveillance visit, 240 pages after it was first introduced, and who was a nurse in the war, steps up to save the day, thus plunging her right into the heart of the Coker family. And then we go backwards to detail Gwendolyn's evening up to that point. After which the direct aftermath of the shooting is completely skipped over, and suddenly we're in the car with Niven driving Gwendolyn home, which is a very weird way to deal with almost the only actual excitement the book has presented so far. I'm not complaining all that much, because the interactions between Gwendolyn and Niven are my favourite part of the book so far, though that might have been intensified by actually seeing them working together to save the gunshot victim. On only an hour or so's acquaintance and no actual direct contact, Nellie offers Gwendolyn the position of manager of one of her clubs, and Gwendolyn accepts, which is a rather ridiculous turn of events on both sides. But it does move the plot along a bit, I suppose, so I guess I shouldn't quibble. The weird back-and-forth structure strikes again when Nelly wakes Niven in the middle of the night, and a chapter ends with her telling him there's an emergency. We then get a whole chapter of Frieda wandering the streets and sleeping in a park. And then we skip ahead, past all the drama, to Edith being in hospital, recovering after a hysterectomy required because of her botched abortion. So all the direct action is skipped and then recounted very briefly after the fact. While sitting at Edith's hospital bedside, the Cokers discuss Gwendolyn and her sudden appearance in their lives. One of the daughters posits that she might be working for Frobisher as a spy, but Nellie dismisses this as ridiculous, which seems a bit on the nose. Unless Nellie knows more than she's letting on and has some kind of plan for Gwendolyn, which seems very likely. Frobisher inspects the body of another drowned girl, and the detailed description of her makes me think I'm supposed to know who it is, but unusually for me, none of the characters are cemented in my mind in terms of appearance. I think maybe it's Frieda's friend Florence, which would be very sad, but I'm really not sure. It's especially horrible when the coroner reveals she would have died even without being thrown in the river due to a badly botched abortion, but it also seems a bit much for that to have happened to two of the female characters now. Plus, Frobisher's attitude towards women is a bit inconsistent. When he's discussing Gwendolyn with another policeman, it says, "He disliked Cobb's impolite she and her, a diminishing of a girl, of a woman." But he diminishes his wife all the time in the way he treats her and thinks about her, not least in admitting to himself an attraction to Gwendolyn and pondering at asking her out to lunch, which isn't particularly respectful towards her either, considering he's married. Florence being the second drowned girl is strongly hinted at again in the next scene, so at least that's not something I'm left wondering about for long. Gwendolyn's cheerful disregard of the very real danger of going to work for Nellie Coker seems rather frivolous of her, not to mention very foolish, though at least Frobisher thinks that too, even if he doesn't try to dissuade her. His reason for that is to keep her in London longer, which is an incredibly selfish reason to allow her to risk herself. There's a great quote that again seems to be potential commentary on the nature of the book when Frobisher has to schlep back to the morgue. "He set off from Bow Street once more. Life was all just coming and going, wasn't it? And then eventually it was just going." He comes across a young girl outside the police station and thinks she looks remarkably like the runaway Frieda, whose photo Gwendolyn has just given him. But instead of asking her name, he gives her some money and sends her on her way. And of course, it turns out it really was Frieda. Grrr! Gwendolyn is taken by surprise when her heart rose a little at the thought of seeing Frobisher. Yes, me too. I mean, I'm definitely rooting for Niven to be the love interest in Gwendolyn's story, even though he's wholly unsuitable. But Frobisher is an even worse prospect, and perhaps I should really be rooting for her to maintain her happy independence. Around the 300-page mark, I find I am enjoying the book a lot more, and I'm glad I decided to persevere. Things are definitely coming together more, and it's starting to feel as if it might be building towards something, but there's still very little forward momentum compared to what I'd expect from a story like this. And then we get another rather pointed quote when Nellie is talking to Gwendolyn about the flat above the Crystal Cup Club. "It's unspoilt, unsullied. Nothing ever happens in here. I find that a great relief." Okay, I get it. Nothing happens, and that's a good thing. Then Niven starts stalking Gwendolyn, which is a bit disappointing. I'll probably have to stop rooting for him after all. Are there any decent male characters in this book? No. There have been quite a few coincidences in the book folks so far, but Frobisher randomly coming across the brooch Frieda pawned earlier and buying it for his wife is a step too far in my opinion. There's been mention of another policeman throughout, Maddox, who is corrupt and has been paid by Nellie to warn her of raids and keep the police off her back. That is, until he decides to betray her and starts trying to bring her down by setting fires and initiating raids on the clubs himself. He doesn't appear directly on the page until the last third of the book, but I still had a visceral reaction of revulsion and disappointment when it's revealed that he is Edith's lover. The Maddox reveal is well seeded with earlier references, but that's not always the case with stuff in this book. Case in point, shortly afterwards there's a section in a Frieda chapter where it talks about Florence being obsessed with fairyland and continually regaling Frieda with rules and warnings about visiting there. Then, in the very next chapter, Frieda presents herself to Ramsay outside the Amethyst Club and demands a job as a dancing hostess. When he gains Nellie's permission to let her in to try out, he says, "Welcome to Fairyland," which feels very clunky. In the opposite vein, on page 354, there's a reference to a character named Maud, and it took me a while to remember this as the name of the ghost supposedly haunting Nellie after her stint in prison. This was mentioned fairly early on, and then once more somewhere in the middle, but only very much in passing. It seems odd to introduce it and only reference it a few times without it actually impacting the story really at all, unless it's somehow going to become significant before the end of the book. Frobisher is both a terrible man and a terrible policeman. After meeting with Gwendolyn for a report on her surveillance activities, he invites her for a jaunt in his newly repaired motor car. Afterwards, it says, he was elated she had agreed to his invitation. He spotted a tram approaching on the other side of the road and set off in pursuit, spurred on by his success, too happy to notice that he was being observed. During the meeting, Gwendolyn also mentions Frieda and Florence, and Frobisher, ack, so many F names, grumpily retorts that he hasn't forgotten about them. But he hasn't pursued the notion that the second body he inspected is likely Florence, and he spoke to Frieda in the street, actually thinking that she looked like the missing girl, and yet didn't check up on that either. I'm really not sure who, if anyone, we're supposed to be rooting for in this book. Gwendolyn, yes, and Frieda, certainly. Even though she created her situation herself by running away, it's very understandable why she did it, and she definitely doesn't deserve what's been happening to her since. Other than that, though, everyone else is either despicable, incompetent, weak, selfish, or any combination of those things. In particular, all the policemen in this book are awful. Maddox and Oakes are both on the take. Additionally, Maddox has been mistreating Edith, and Oakes beats his wife, and together they're running a prostitution ring using young runaways they pick up off the streets, some of whom end up in the river. Constable Cobb is disrespectful to women and abandons Gwendolyn at the first sign of trouble at the Amethyst Club. The desk sergeant at Bow Street is insubordinate and less than dedicated to his job, also demonstrating a very dismissive attitude towards women. And Frobisher sidles up to Gwendolyn while simultaneously thinking badly of his wife. He also near discovers what's been happening to the missing girls because Edith contacts him out of the blue to report Maddox rather than through any investigations of his own. It's a relief to discover that Nellie has been aware of Gwendolyn's association with Frobisher from the start, and it makes everything that's happened with them make a lot more sense. But this confirmation of Nellie's acuity doesn't really track with her continued interactions with the ghost Maud and thinking she might actually be able to affect her physical surroundings. By the time the link between Atzapardi and Nellie is revealed, it was his loot she took from her dead landlady's rooms years before, which allowed her to start her empire in the first place, it's been 360 pages since the jewels have even been mentioned, so while the reveal has technically been seeded, I'd completely forgotten about it in the interim, so it feels a bit arbitrary rather than satisfying. Gwendolyn's attitude to Frobisher seems very inconsistent. Her heart lifts at the thought of seeing him, but she also considers him a dry stick and constantly compares him unfavourably to Niven. There's not much information provided as to why she's attracted to him as much as she is. She's even disappointed in herself for not thinking better of him when it's clear he should be the better choice, not that I necessarily concur. And yet she agrees to go out with him for the day on a whim and seems intrigued by his character. Then there's another tremendous coincidence when Frieda runs into her old friend Vanda from the knitwear company in the street. While Vanda and Duncan have only appeared in flashbacks and odd references in Frieda's narrative, it's very upsetting to discover that Duncan hanged himself in prison and Vanda is now working as a prostitute. It also seems unnecessary. And that's another inconsistent thing about the book. For the most part, it's fairly light, with little in the way of emotional impact, but Frieda's storyline is, by contrast, extremely hard-hitting in a way that feels very out of keeping with the rest of the book, though things do get darker the more they connect together. Gwendolyn continues to disappoint me when Niven turns up at her door unexpectedly, and she offers to sleep with him out of spite after her discovery that Frobisher is married, though Niven claws back some points by not taking advantage of her. The whole Atzapardi subplot is seemingly resolved very easily by Nellie just giving him the jewels back, since she's apparently actually only sold one of them, which I guess is in keeping with so little really happening in the book. And then Frobisher finds Frieda, but entirely by chance yet again, as he happens to be crossing a bridge at the right time to see her struggling in the river and manages to save her. Though she discharges herself from the hospital and disappears again, so it's not a full resolution. And then everything comes to a head very quickly with many short sections of text that switch between locations and viewpoints very rapidly. Atzapardi comes back into it to reveal that the jewels are all fakes, since Nellie has actually sold them all after all, but he's quickly dispatched by his own gun in Nellie's hands, so even though it wasn't as easy a resolution as it previously seemed, it's only resurrected for 3 pages before being knocked on the head again. I'm not sure how I feel about Edith actually killing Maddox, but I am sure how I feel about Frobisher being distracted by Gwendolyn kissing him. I mean, him diving into the river to save Frieda doesn't stop him from being married, and then stepping out in front of a truck. It's a really stupid way for his story to end, not least because the truck is full of cabbages, so it just makes me think of the cabbage seller in Avatar The Last Airbender whose cart keeps being upended by the main character's shenanigans. It looks like Ramsay is going to gain literary success, but only by stealing Quinn's novel after his murder and passing it off as his own, but it turns out not to be very good, so it doesn't sell, which is a decent comeuppance for him. It seems like a shame that Frieda doesn't ever let her sister, Sissy, know she's okay, since Sissy showed enough care to get Gwendolyn to come down to London to look for her. But I suppose Gwendolyn knows from Frobisher that Frieda is alive, at least at one point before she disappears again. The fates of Nelly and most of the rest of her children are pretty grim, and laid out in a single paragraph in the last chapter, which seems like a very uncharitable way to conclude things, if you ask me. The whole of the section at the end that goes through all the characters is very much summary, and also rather dreary all told, which casts rather a pall on the end of the book. And then we get a weird interlude where Niven turns up at Gwendolyn's flat and asks her to go to America with him, but we don't actually find out if she agrees to go or not, so that's quite frustrating. We go back to the newspaper boy from the very beginning for the execution of Sergeant Oakes, which is orchestrated in quite complicated fashion by the Coker clan. And then, 509 pages after he's first introduced, we're told the boy's name is Norman and that he subsequently dies during the invasion of Sicily in 1944. What on earth is the point of that, other than just to be incredibly depressing for no reason at all? And then, after all that, we get a final 2 pages where Florence randomly turns up back at home in York and isn't dead after all. So the ultimate conclusion of the book is full of unnecessarily tragic fates of characters, which are delivered in rapid-fire fashion, but then it swings wildly back to the positive in a way that almost gives me whiplash. Very weird. In terms of diversity, there's a vast array of varied and very interesting female characters, many more than there are male ones. The fact that one of the main ones, Nelly, is in late middle age is also welcome and refreshing. Gwendolyn wants neither husband nor child, just the independence of her inheritance, at least at the start of the book anyway. Poor 14-year-old Frieda suffers not one, not two, but 3 sexual assaults during the course of the book, but given her circumstances, that's unfortunately not unrealistic. The portrayal of Frobisher's wife Lottie and her clearly significant mental health issues isn't good, but then it's through Frobisher's eyes, and it's unreasonable to expect a decent level of understanding of that from someone like him in 1926. There is the suggestion that Duncan, someone from Frieda's past, is gay, but it's only mentioned a couple of times in a rather oblique way, and he's also a character who only appears intermittently in flashback as part of another character's background story. Niven refers to his brother Ramsay as an effeminate man pretending not to be, and there's mention of an encounter where Ramsay's friend Quinn makes a pass at him and Ramsay is forced to fight him off. He afterwards tells the barman at the club where it happens that he's not like that, but the suggestion is that he's in denial, which turns out to be true since we last see Ramsay in bed with Gerrit, the giant bartender from the Sphinx Club. There's also mention of clubs where women seek out the company of other women, with the explanation that this has increased in popularity in the post-war years where there are far fewer men around than previously, but that's not something that's explored in any detail, and it's made clear it doesn't happen in any of Nelly's clubs. There's a reference to the racial diversity in London at the time, when it talks about the varied clientele of the different clubs owned by Nelly, but there's not a lot of diversity in the actual characters from that point of view, other than Ramsay repeatedly referring to Atsop Hardy as the Maltese. In terms of overall thoughts, the writing is good. The descriptions, the characters, the turns of phrase, all excellent, but basically nothing happens. It's all just vibes, as they say nowadays, which isn't always a bad thing, but I was expecting intrigue, crime, investigations, excitement, and the tiny morsels of plot progression that are intermittently dropped into the sea of background information and mundane minutiae just didn't do it for me. I remembered the sections about Ramsay writing his novel being awesome, and they are, but they only appear twice, which is a lot less than I'd thought, and only the first one is funny, which is disappointing since they were one of the main reasons I wanted to reread the book. The book has an amazing array of different types of characters, but unfortunately all of the ones I liked to start with disappointed me to a greater or lesser extent by the end, and that ending is tonally very inconsistent and ties everything up in very short order after such a rambling journey to get to the conclusion. There are also a couple of stylistic choices that pulled me up. The head-hopping is one, which I've already discussed, but during certain scenes, there'll be 2 characters having a conversation, and then the narrative will change to what are apparently the internal thoughts of the viewpoint character for a bit, but then the other character will continue the conversation as if those thoughts have been spoken aloud, which presumably they have, and it's very confusing. Looking back to my original review, it turns out it was in October 2022, so actually much more recent than I remembered. Here's what I thought the first time around. The book follows the interwoven stories of multiple different characters in London in 1926, the matriarch of a crime family and her various children, a police inspector, a librarian from York, and 2 14-year-old runaways. It took a while for me to get into it, since there was a great deal of summary background for all the characters as they were introduced, which was done in multiple page sections of quite dry exposition. However, I persevered and I was glad I did, as once the story got going properly, it was really good. The switching back and forth in time and skipping over directly showing various important scenes was a bit annoying, but overall I loved all the characters, it was pretty funny in places, and I liked the way it eventually all came together. There was another whole section of aftermath summary explaining what happened to all the different characters, some of which seemed unnecessary and very arbitrary, but overall a very involving read. So, I was apparently annoyed by the same things the first time I read this book, but it seems the more positive aspects had a greater impact on me, leading to me enjoying it more than this time. So, at least I remember correctly that I had enjoyed it. And that's it for this episode of Reviews Revisited. Next month I'm going to be revisiting The Three by Sarah Lotz. Many thanks to Cambo for our theme music, and thank you so much for listening. If you like the show, please rate and review it wherever you get your podcasts. And if you have any comments, or if you want to tell me about a time you revisited some media and whether or not you still loved it afterwards, you can email me at willyoustilloveit@gmail.com. I'd love to hear from you. Lastly, please join us for the next main episode of Will You Still Love It tomorrow in 2 weeks to hear what happens when our friend Nick and I get Dave to watch Dirty Dancing. Will Dave like it at all? And will Nick and I still love it after our discussion? I'm looking forward to finding out. Bye for now.